You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of Avedon Ascendant by Philip Gefter. There's more than a little bit of dough in the barefoot, sure-eyed model standing on the ersatz beach, game for some new excitement. Her unaffected spontaneity is a quality that came to characterize the Avedon woman throughout Dick's entire career. Avedon's real fascinations, Vassman said, were androgyny and theatricality, referring specifically to her impressions of him on Fire Island. In fact, Dick created the Harper's Bazaar cover less than 3 months after his and Doe's first glimpse of Cherry Grove, and it is not a stretch to suggest that the narrative dreamscape it depicts is also an exacting portrait of his soon-to-be-failed marriage. The couple's marriage ended in 1949, and Avedon began sessions with a psychoanalyst whose specialty included curing homosexuality long before the practice of conversion therapy was uniformly debunked. While Dick would marry Evelyn Franklin in 1951 and would have a son, John, he remained closeted for most of his life. He would have occasional affairs with men, but as a man of his generation, these relationships were clandestine and few. In February 1947, Dick was assigned to photograph Jerome Robbins, the choreographer, for a profile in Bazaar's April issue. Robbins had already been anointed a young nobleman of dance for his brilliant ballet, Fancy Free, with music by Leonard Bernstein and inspired by a Paul Cadmus canvas entitled The Fleet's Inn, which culture writer Anna Kisselgoff once referred to as a typically erotic painting of sailors having a good time. Fancy Free premiered at the Metropolitan Opera House in 1944, and the New York Times dance critic John Martin singled out Robbins as a first-class artist. It was only Jerome Robbins' Fancy Free that saved the season from being predominantly dull. It is a beautifully built little ballet, gay in spirit and genuine in substance. Dick had some familiarity with Fancy Free, since the ballet's run coincided with the end of his military service, when he had been taking modern dance classes alongside John Butler and Tannikil Leclerc, who would later marry George Balanchine. Dick would have recognized himself in the three sailors, and his eye would have been attuned to their graceful physical charm, which used pure gesture to articulate pride, bravado, infatuation, sexual desire, and jealousy. The dance was underscored by Bernstein's mournful music, with its urgent rhythms and strains of melancholy in what is essentially a modern mating ritual. While Robbins and Bernstein were virtual unknowns when the show premiered that April, these new kids on the block, the Times noted, were overnight sensations, the proverbial talk of the town. Later that year, On the Town, the Broadway production that Robbins, Bernstein, Betty Comden, and Adolph Green created out of Fancy Free, opened on Broadway. Both productions would go on to become milestones in American musical theater as well as the ballet. Jerome Robbins, née Jerome Rabinowitz, from Weehawken, New Jersey, a darling of the stage and merely 5 years Avedon's senior, would serve as a kind of beacon for Dick's unbounded ambition, not least because he would find surprising similarities in their backgrounds. Like Dick, Robbins had an unforgiving father, a small businessman who did not want him to go into the arts. Robbins, likewise, had had to extricate himself from the family business in order to commence his study of dance, writes Terry Teachout. "I didn't want to be like my father," the Jew, Robbins would later write, I wanted to be safe, protected, assimilated, hidden in among the goys, the majority. Dick would recognize Robbins' self-contempt, and not only about his Judaism. Robbins' attitude toward his queerness, as he referred to it, was equally conflicted, writes Teachout. Though he readily declared his sexual orientation to avoid serving in World War II, he also had involvements with women then and later. Please save me from being gay and dirty, Robbins wrote in a 1942 diary entry, not long before his draft board classified him as 4F. People close to Robbins and Bernstein acknowledged that their professional relationship was like a marriage. They were very, very close, and their interactions could be stormy. Both were bisexual, and it's possible that they were once, briefly, lovers. Avedon would photograph Bernstein the following year, another beacon that brought the reach of his own driving ambition a little closer to the realm of his own daily reality. All three men had grown up as middle-class Jews, each one driven by an internal imperative to create something of meaning out of their own exigent talents and give it significant cultural form. Richard Avedon would later come to realize that it generally took a decade or two for the future to happen. Prescient artists would foresee shifts in the culture and then express, and in many cases precipitate, those changes, using their artworks as auguries for what would later transpire in society at large. Such was the case in 1945, when Dick was first getting his footing at Harper's Bazaar. That spring, staffers at the magazine were all abuzz about a short story called Miriam that had just been published in Rival Mademoiselle, the first piece by a precociously talented 21-year-old author. With her canny intuition, Carmel Snow, the editor-in-chief, declared that the writer's next story had to be published in the Bazaar. And so it was. A Tree of Night appeared in the October 1945 issue, and Avedon found himself in the same freshman class as Truman Capote. At one of Mrs. Snow's parties that year, at which Dick may have been in attendance, Mary Aswell, the fiction editor, brought along Capote. Carmel, who had not yet been introduced to the new young writer, spotted this boyish creature standing by himself and assumed he was the younger brother of someone on her editorial staff. She offered him a glass of milk. In his high, nasally voice, Capote introduced himself. She burst into uproarious laughter at her mistake, apologizing profusely and fetching him a martini. She then introduced him around, repeating the story of her blunder to everybody, relishing the rounds of laughter each time. The first of many martinis that Truman and I have downed together over the years, Carmel would go on to say. Near the end of the decade, after Capote's first novel, Other Voices, Other Rooms, had been published, he told Gore Vidal that he was working on his next one, about a beautiful New York debutante. What on earth do you know about debutantes? Vidal said. Everything, Capote countered. After all, I am one. Eleanor Marcus, soon to become the Baroness de la Boulie, was a debutante of that era and one of Capote's earliest best pals in Manhattan, his adopted home after growing up in Louisiana and Alabama. On several occasions, she went with him to visit a woman she described as the actual inspiration for Holly Golightly, an unconventional blonde who lived in a small studio in a brownstone near Capote's apartment on Lexington Avenue in the East 90s. Meanwhile, Eleanor's older sister, the stage actor Carol Marcus Grace, a friend of Avedon's long before she married William Saroyan twice, and later actor Walter Matthau, told people that she was the inspiration for Holly Golightly. After late evenings of rehearsal, followed by wee-hour drinking in a private nightclub on West 55th Street, she and Capote would end up having coffee together in front of Tiffany's in the silvery light of dawn. Every morning about 7 o'clock, we left the Gold Key Club and walked to Fifth Avenue, where there was a man with donuts and coffee, she wrote in her memoir. We'd buy some and continue to Tiffany's, where we would look in the windows and fantasize. Anne Woodward, a model and fashionable showgirl in the 1940s, who married the very wealthy and socially prominent William Woodward, Jr., a scion of a banking fortune, was yet another of the many Holly-go-lightly figures who make their appearances throughout Truman's oeuvre, Sam Kashner has observed in Vanity Fair. Beautiful, social-climbing waifs from the rural South who move to New York and reinvent themselves, not unlike Truman's own personal journey. And then there was Dorian Lee, one of Dick Avedon's favorite models, who believed herself to be the true inspiration for Holly. She, like the fictional character, had left her husband behind and her children in the care of her parents in search of a glamorous, carefree life as a model in New York. She lived in Capote's neighborhood and received her telephone messages from gentlemen callers and her modeling agency at the candy store across the street, a ritual Capote often observed while buying his cigarettes. Capote himself started calling her happy-go-lucky in the 1950s. Capote always said that Holly-go-lightly was a composite of the many women he knew, some of whom would come and go in Avedon's studio. In fact, the idea of Holly-go-lightly can be spotted throughout Avedon's work. Nathalie Nickerson, who appeared on Dick's first cover for Bazaar, stands as if a prototype of a confident Holly-go-lightly in her orange short shorts, legs akimbo. She arrived in New York from Phoenix and lived in virtual poverty in her first year in the city until Eileen Ford took her on and made her a top model almost overnight. She would eventually have her own personal stationery, first name only, stylishly engraved without any capital letters, Natalie, the Barbizon, 140 East 63rd Street, New York, 21. Avedon would reinvent what a beautiful woman is, and the visualization of that idea over and over and over again in his photographs, whether with Natalie Nickerson, Dorian Lee, or later, the model Dovima, whom he'd famously pose in an evening gown amid a group of elephants. These Avedon women would no doubt influence Capote in his own formulation of Holly-go-lightly in the decade to come. The idea of Holly-go-lightly is relevant to a definition of Richard Avedon's sensibility. Manhattan in the late 1940s was a petri dish in which the cultural matter of the second half of the 20th century was germinating in art and literature, music and dance, film and theater. Dick was not only picking up on the spectacular newness of the ideas and attitudes in his midst, he was participating in the visualization of a cultural metamorphosis. Capote's Breakfast at Tiffany's, like Bernstein, Arthur Lawrence, and Stephen Sondheim's West Side Story, would not enter the collective unconscious for another decade, yet they both came out of this optimistic post-war moment in which Dick's creativity, too, was establishing new precedents that would prevail as abiding touchstones of mid-20th century American exuberance and individuality. In that pivotal decade, everyone Dick knew was trying to reinvent himself or herself, whether it was the change of name from Jewish to Gentile, or in his own case, the transformation of a struggling middle-class neurotic and closeted gay Jewish man into an accomplished, eminent, and debonair man about town. What's more, in his fashion work, he was inventing a visual iconography in which to put forward a thoroughly modern woman with a new, more carefree independence of mind and manner. A style that was reflected in the motion and poised spontaneity of his pictures. Avedon's greatest creation has been a kind of woman, photographer Irving Penn once said. I know her, I'd recognize her if she walked in this room. She's sisterly, laughs a great deal. To me, this is a very great achievement. It's a kind of woman I'm talking about, projected through one very powerful intellect and creative genius. Penn went on to state that Avedon had even forged a new style of woman for the era itself. She's a very real woman, and not to be mixed up with any other age. The way she stands, the curious stance of her feet planted wide apart, was something unique. A revolution of the nice woman and the world has changed because of this. As a photographer, I'm fascinated by Avedon's frozen instant of a laugh or an expression that comes about. As a moment in time, I'm very fascinated and touched and moved by these. Doe Avedon, on the beach at Fire Island in 1946, became Leonard Gersh's Joe Stockton in Funny Face, portrayed by Audrey Hepburn a decade later. Capote's Holly Golightly, partly channeling Avedon's treasured 1940s model, Dorian Lee, achieved her cinematic apotheosis in the character played by Hepburn in the 1961 film Breakfast at Tiffany's. Doe and Joe, Dorian and Holly and Audrey, by every measure of their spontaneity, idiosyncrasy, tomboyish figure, and sublime urban chic, together consummate the Avedon woman. She was the woman of the future, conjured by a man who would go on until his death in 2004 to photograph every giant of American culture for the next 5 decades.
Thank you.
traitors among us. Pop culture goes soft on some of the more controversial women in American history by Sonia Soraya. Opening photo, Kate Blanchett, playing Phyllis Schlafly in the miniseries Mrs. America. The people who drive pop culture seem mystified by Republican women. Perhaps it's simply that by design they seem to recede in plain sight. The Barbara Bushes and Nancy Reagans of the world, with their out-of-date hairstyles, monochromatic twin sets, and strings of demure pearls. Our biopics and investigative reports rarely delve into their psyche. So thoroughly do these women fulfill our ideas of a type that the mind glosses over them and moves on to the man they are invariably standing next to. For all that Hollywood and the mainstream media are supposed to be a hotbed of liberal propaganda, we pull our punches when it comes to the tales of handmaidens of conservative politics. If women's suffrage anticipated a voting bloc comprised of women voting for women's issues, the 2016 election shredded that notion. An oft-cited statistic based on exit polls is that 53% of white female voters cast their ballots for Trump, choosing not just a male candidate over a female one, but a proud sexual predator at that. The reality is that the woman voter has always been driven by more than identity politics. Women still oppose the Equal Rights Amendment, just as women opposed suffrage in 1920. Many American women today oppose paid family leave and raucously campaign against abortion access. But on TV and in movies, where character is built on identity and where conflict must move toward resolution, this reality is difficult to convey. Characterization is an attempt to evoke empathy. When Hollywood takes on conservative women, the empathy often feels grafted on, sometimes shamelessly. Consider the 2011 film The Iron Lady, which won Meryl Streep an Oscar for her sensitive portrayal of dying Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. Screenwriter A.B. Morgan used Thatcher's dementia as a way to explore the politician's uneasy legacy. But the illness, a tragedy for anyone, became a cloying veil that obscured Thatcher's real effect on her nation. Former London Mayor Ken Livingstone put it this way, at the time of Thatcher's death, she created today's housing crisis, she created the banking crisis, and she created the benefits crisis. The late Prime Minister sent British troops to train the Khmer Rouge, befriended the dictator Augusto Pinochet, and demonized the gay community. Under her rule, poverty and inequality spiked in the United Kingdom, and the country has arguably never recovered. This is who Streep humanized with her extraordinary gifts. Imagine a liberal female politician being treated to this kind of hagiography. Hillary Clinton, say. Imagine the vitriol that would follow. Women with conservative politics get to have it both ways. Thanks to feminists laboriously pushing society into the modern era, they have the advantage of being a protected class. Yet conservative white women in particular also have an ideology that elevates them over women from other racial or socioeconomic backgrounds. They believe they're superior to the rest of their gender. The writer Ariel Levy calls them loophole women and become honorary men. Phyllis Schlafly might be the quintessential loophole woman, at least as portrayed in Davy Waller's immersive, maddening series, Mrs. America. Kate Blanchett plays Schlafly as a woman who uses the ERA as a platform for her own devouring political ambitions and ends up throwing the women's movement under the bus. The series shies away from exploring Schlafly's ideology too closely, though. even as the character forms a shaky alliance with homophobes and the KKK. Mrs. America brilliantly portrays the how of Schlafly, but the why of her remains out of reach. I don't mean to pick on Waller's show. The fact is, it does more to understand the Republican woman than most. The issue here is a collective difficulty with understanding and engaging with the conditions under which an empowered woman sides against empowering other women, sides with a system that continues to exploit them even as we speak. Hollywood's lesser efforts often end up caught between contempt and confusion, turning their subjects into caricature. Last year's movie Bombshell from director Jay Roach is a potent example. Yes, the women of Fox News end up taking down harasser-in-chief Roger Ailes, led by Gretchen Carlson's lawsuit. But with Megyn Kelly in particular, the film seems to throw up its hands in confusion, airing the most toxic on-air clips from her tenure in the background of scenes where she struggles in the face of an institutional shakedown. The movie's poignancy is in how these women, invariably blonde and leggy, never expected to need feminism's protections, let alone to seek them out. They were too good for feminism, but at least in the eyes of the state of New Jersey, feminism was not too good for them. A telling detail, the women rarely, if ever, speak to each other. The law protects their gender, but it can't inspire a sisterhood. Kelly's reprehensible politics didn't stop her from becoming a feminist darling of sorts. The same narrative has aided and abetted real-life Trump advisors Sarah Huckabee Sanders, Kellyanne Conway, and Hope Hicks, whose politics are often presented as a mere appendage to their careers, a case of team loyalty and little else. The failure of imagination as to what motivates these women leads to either breathless speculation about their secret inner conflict of virtually every news item about Hicks, or certainly that on some level they're really feminist, Kelly. The reality is that these women have pledged allegiance to the patriarchy. Trump values Sanders, Hicks, Conway, and his new spokeswoman Kayleigh McEnany solely for their loyalty to him. And as he keeps reminding us, his daughter Ivanka is impressive because she's very pretty. For all that these women claim to be liberated and disingenuously use feminism as a shield, it's telling how reluctant they are to become leaders in their own right, instead of mouthpieces and extensions of men. As Sanders offhandedly told Marie Claire in 2011, "I'm a total daddy's girl. I learned at a very early age that if I said daddy in just the right way, I could pretty much get anything I wanted." Spike Lee leaves no doubt as to the motivations of the conservative women in his movie Black Klansman. A group of white couples, Klansmen and their wives, gather in an empty classroom to watch D.W. Griffith's landmark racist film, The Birth of a Nation. The mood is celebratory. With short, brutal strokes, Lee constructs the tribal, racist worldview of these women and their men, a hierarchy where their comfort is built on the backs of others. No, not all Republican women are white nationalists, but as Seward Darby wrote for Harper's and expands upon in Sisters in Hate, out this month, white women have long been essential helpmeets to white nationalism, which the alt-right has adopted nearly wholesale. It's baffling, because white nationalism often goes hand in hand with misogynist rhetoric, reinforcing the role of the woman as separate and distinct from the man's, and sometimes even claiming that the wombs of white women belong to white men outright. Some women are content with circumscribed power, as long as it upholds their racial narrative. Maybe the problem is that any attempt to penetrate these hateful ideologies is met with the blinding defense of belief, as if a belief cannot be interrogated or built on rotten foundations. Imagine a world where we could dissect the pro-life movement's suspiciously recent rise to the forefront of evangelical priorities, or note that as women have gained political power, they have steadily lost control over what happens inside their own uteruses. We may be more liberated than ever, but we do not live in that world. If you want to see TV and film truly explore morally compromised women complicit in corporate greed and government surveillance and outright murder, your best bet is science fiction. Try Westworld. As we hurtle toward the 2020 election, our blindness to what creates and motivates these women feels like a ticking bomb. The less we understand their motivations, the better it is for them. They remain shielded by our tied tongues and politesse. Perhaps this absence is why the term Karen has become so indispensable in the online discourse of 2020. A nickname drawn from African-American vernacular, a Karen is a type. Lately, the type of woman who protests pandemic lockdown because she needs to get her nails done, but more broadly, the type of white woman who calls the police to report an infringement on her privilege, even when she's the one breaking the rules. It's not the most precise language. White nationalist racist gender traitor seems a bit stronger, but it gets us to some kind of understanding. It's a start. And this article appeared many months ago in Vanity Fair magazine, but seemed worthwhile to read again. Thank you. Attention shoppers, the hottest place to see and be seen in Hollywood, a grocery store, Inside the Cult of Erewhon by Michelle Ruiz. With opening photo of the store by Michelle Grosskopf. Cara Delevingne, Ashley Benson, and a rubber-gloved Kaia Gerber were spotted on a friend date there in March. In April, Jake Gyllenhaal and Demi Lovato each popped in wearing masks, followed by Hilary Duff in May and Miley Cyrus in June. After reportedly splitting from Delevingne, Benson returned in July with rapper Jeezy. In August, ASAP Rocky scanned the snackage. Stefan Voice, the hottest pandemic club in Los Angeles, is Erewhon, the all-organic, frequently macrobiotic VIP room of grocery stores, where vegan coconut yogurt costs $19, and there's a naturopathic doctor on staff to recommend calming reishi mushrooms. According to Erewhon Twitter, Steven Tyler once whispered, "You're beautiful," to a female shopper, and Ellen may or may not have reamed out the hot bar staff for running out of scrambled eggs. Under a statewide stay-at-home order that shuttered Hollywood, amid an attention apocalypse in which there was nowhere to go and, worse, nowhere to be seen, stars still flocked to Erewhon. Pronounced Erewhon, but in certain surfer dude lilts is reduced to two syllables, Erewhon. The prepared buffalo cauliflower is a near erotic experience for many, but the real draw of Erewhon is that it's a scene. Chef and fresh off the boat author Eddie Wong emailed from Taipei. You bump into everyone you matched on Rea or once met at Benny Blanco's house. Unsure of where they'd snap celebrities in a dystopian Hollywood, paparazzi set up among the shopping carts in parking lots across Erewhon's six-store mini-empire, including Fairfax, Venice, and the Kardashian-settled Calabasas. You used to get celebrities there on occasion pre-pandemic, said Grant Hodgson, news editor at photo agency Backgrid. Leonardo DiCaprio and Dakota Johnson are regulars. Kanye West famously tweeted about the Erewhon drip, a trying, not trying outfit of fleece, sweats, and one athletic sandal. But post-pandemic, it's become an absolute staple. It's more popular than ever. For shoppers of the Who Weekly set, your Brody Jenners and Tommy Dorfmans, an Erewhon jaunt under quarantine offers both CBD lemonade and a stab at relevance. It says, "I'm going to the grocery store," says Chris Black, co-founder of brand consultancy Public Announcement and a self-aware Erewhon shopper. Even though it's a grocery store where everything is very expensive and it's completely out of reach of most Americans, full carts are a status symbol that Black estimates can cost $1,000 if you're not buying vitamins, another pandemic inequity, considering L.A. County is the most food insecure in the nation. When COVID-19 hit, Erewhon doubled down on its trademark California chill, creating a safe haven for privileged clientele. "We have such a warrior spirit," said Jason Wedner, Erewhon Vice President of Store Development and a former actor who played a young Josiah Bartlett on The West Wing. The Goop-endorsed tonic bar crafted a blood-red, immunity-boosting, lung-fortifying tonic full of amazing adaptogenic ingredients such as shaga, astragalus, cordyceps, and platycodon. Erewhon opened early for the elderly and gave them free chlorophyll water. A few next-door complaints reported Erewhon shoppers failed to social distance, but those who balked at the store's mask order weren't turned away. "If you can't put your mask on, listen. Give me your credit card. Give me a list," Widener said, he told people at the door. "I will go shop for you personally right now." Director Sebastian Siegel, an Erewhon devotee, declined to stock up on groceries. He only wanted to spend more time at Erewhon during the pandemic. "I'm very comfortable with whatever the world has to serve up," Siegel says. as long as it's not buffalo cauliflower, which he doesn't eat because starch. Erewhon considers itself much more than a grocer. It's a community of like-minded people, bonded by a love of locally plucked figs. Its name is an anagram of nowhere, an homage to Samuel Butler's 1872 novel about what appears to be a utopian society. Others have noted that Erewhon is also the name of the prison in the 1997 cult classic Face Off. "You don't even have to talk to each other," said Leisha Dalimore, Erewhon's vice president of brand. "The eye contact that you make waiting for your tonic bar beverage is this comforting moment, like, we'll get through this together." Next photos, Cara Delevingne and Kaya Gerber. Jake Gyllenhaal. When the original Erewhon opened its doors in Boston in 1966, there weren't enough grains to stock the shelves, just a modest supply of whole wheat in an old-fashioned general store. Natural foods bubbled up as options in the 1940s in response to DDT and chemical farming, but health nuttery remained on the fringe while TV dinners took off. Erewhon's married co-founders were the late Michio and Aveline Kushi. Michio, who came to America from Japan in 1949 as a political science student, adopted the ethos that natural foods could be a gateway to world peace. Healthy people create healthy, peaceful families, communities, society, and eventually the world, is how macrobiotic counselor Denny Waxman, who trained with the Kushis at the original Erewhon, describes the philosophy. It was a biological revolution. Erewhon became a hangout, with people piling into vans and driving hundreds of miles to visit. According to Waxman, Aveline was the dynamo behind Erewhon's expansion to Los Angeles in 1969, 11 years before Whole Foods' founding. "Whole Foods did a great job up until about 10 years ago," Widner said, "when it changed its produce from organic to an organic plus conventional mix, then got Amazoned. Meanwhile, Kraft had given way to Annie's, and organic food became the $50 billion business Erewhon had planted the seeds for. 2 decades ago, Erewhon was still a single, funky, old-school health food store, where Moon Juice founder Amanda Chantal Bacon met store legend Truth Calkins, manning an outpost of L.A. herbal bar Dragon Herbs inside Erewhon. Calkins was my favorite bartender, Chantal Bacon says, delivering custom elixirs for immunity, exhaustion, or her cycle. I don't drink, so this really was like my version of going to a bar. Widner quips, I always say get high off the good stuff. So began Erewhon's metamorphosis from groovy grocer to social club. Widner remembers James Gandolfini circling the tonic bar before his death in 2013. I was like, dude, stop staring at the menu. Come here and let me help you, he says. Jennifer Garner's Once Upon a Farm baby food landed on shelves in 2016, and a pregnant Kim Kardashian came in. Widner grew very close with other celebrities he wishes he could name. I can call Owen Wilson anytime I want. People like that. The rise of Instagram, coupled with the nebulous notion of wellness, helped make Erewhon the new Ivy, a stories-worthy scene where influencers in mauve leggings pop their heels before the rainbow wall of juices. It attracts guys who drive G-wagons and girls who are sporty and rich and like Yeezys, Black says. Those people, 5 to 10 years ago, would have been in a club, doing coke, partying, drinking. Now, being healthy is cool. Having a $30 lunch at a grocery store is cool. Under new owner Tony Antocci, Erewhon has gone wide, expanding from one store to six, following the luxury high-rises into newly gentrified neighborhoods. On season two of You, Penn Badgley's pathological Joe works at Anavrin, an anagram of Nirvana, an obvious Erewhon stand-in. The chain inspires love and mockery in equal measure. Erewhon serves a function for really rich, lazy people who want to shop for produce and perhaps cross paths with someone they forgot to have sex with, Huang says. Widner claims to love my question about Erewhon's high prices, maintaining that practically every product in the store has a detailed Portlandia sketchworthy backstory. The Pacamama Farm sausage from Oregon is the best sausage in the world, he said. They're wild foresting animals. But Erewhon downplays that it's a capitalist enterprise. Profit is the side effect of our real purpose, Antochi declares on the website. Erewhon could soon bring its characteristically California business back to the East Coast. Ever since New York private equity firm Stripes assumed an ownership stake in 2019, a New York outpost has been buzzed about. Erewhon can become a national brand, Stripes founder Ken Fox told Forbes last year. Can it? Lux grocers like Citarella and Dean and DeLuca, rest in peace, have long been the provenance of Upper East Side doyens, while the influencer set flits to Chacha Macha. People are wearing full-on outfits when it's 100 degrees to go get some kale, Black laughed of the paparazzi-documented Erewhon outing. It's a scene that can only exist in L.A. double vision. With a little help from her friend Stella McCartney, Cindy Sherman takes her photographic avatars in a bold new direction by Alexandra Petchman. In the photo, undercover, untitled number 615 from 2019. And all clothing in this photo are from the Stella McCartney Spring 2017 menswear collection. Schiaparelli and Dali, McQueen and Hearst, Vuitton and Murakami, fashion designers and artists, have long joined forces to demonstrate the power and creative energy in collaboration. But for Stella McCartney and Cindy Sherman, it's more than just an industry partnership. It's a friendship, though not without a hint of starstruck fandom. McCartney gushes about Sherman in a phone call. "I always sort of bowed down at Cindy's feet like, I worship you, and she's always been embarrassed." Sherman laughs, not denying it. Little artifice exists between the fashion force and the chameleonic photographer, perhaps ironically, given their mutual interest in the varied selves a woman presents. 3 years ago, McCartney gave Sherman full access to her brand's archive, and their easy rapport and resulting collaboration inspired Sherman's latest series, an exhibition of 10 large-scale untitled works, which opened at New York's Metro Pictures Gallery in September. In the photographs, Sherman poses as characters who challenge fixed ideas about gender, nearly all dressed in Stella McCartney. One of Sherman's first questions when making the work was, "What does a man pose as?" Her experimentation often manifested as couples. "I would do the male character first, and then just add a little bit of lipstick or mascara and change the outfit," she says. "My thought was how easily one can view someone as male or female. You don't know whether it's women's wear or men's wear," McCartney says. "The art is strangely aligned with what I do in my work, but better." Both of them laugh at her summation. "Yours is way better." This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.